Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 37. Now, once again, 37 is a prime number. It's the 21st prime number, actually. It's the atomic number of rubidium, which I must admit I've never heard of before. 37 is also the human body temperature in degrees Celsius. Kepler 37 is the smallest known planet. And there's also 37 slots on a European roulette wheel, numbered 0 to 36. The 00 is not used in the European roulettes as it's used in American roulettes.
Did you know that all the numbers on a roulette wheel add up to 666?
Oh, wow. Well, we'll have to remember that for episode 666 then.
Yeah, if we're not senile by then.
But that's all. We've got about 37. Apart from one extra thing we've got to add to 37 is this awesome episode that's coming up now. So what have you both been up to this week?
Yeah, well, I've had a bit of a learn by your mistakes this week. Always check the hardware status of whatever you're working on quite early on. I know I've heard on people on other podcasts where people say about if you're doing a virus removal or something, or PCs running, so it would run that hard disk check what everyone goes on about.
Which is crystal like disk info.
Yeah, to see if it's got any issues on the disk. Because it could be that the issues you're actually fixing and not actually spyware or anything, it could actually just be the hardware dying. Well, I had a call passed to me where they were got two terminal servers in a farm and the CPU was going on 100%. And I couldn't work out why they were going on 100%. Terminal server 1 was working fine. Terminal server 2 wasn't working fine. They had about the same amount of users on there. And there's just like 10 users on there. It was just pegging at 100%. But there's nothing really taking it. So I basically took it out of the farm, put it in. So they went on the first server, ran virus scans on their malware scans. Can't see anything wrong with it. Looking at if there's any different software which has been installed which isn't on the other one. Just spent ages trying to look it out. So kept trying things, put it into production. No, keeps failing. So these two terminal servers are running virtually on a Hyper-V host, so on a physical host, with about another four virtual machines on it. And none of the other servers, so the five servers are working fine, except the sixth one. And it was all running fine, so I looked at the Hyper-V host. Nothing majorly happened wrong. The CPU is hardly being used. The memory was hard. About 50% of the memory is being used. So this was all a bit odd. So in the end, we decided, well, if we know that the terminal server 1's working fine and we know that server 2, we'll just delete terminal server 2 and we're just, from the backup, we'll restore terminal server 1 as a restore. Using a product actually called Datto, which it's quite a new product I use. We'll talk about Veeam, but Datto is like a NAS device where you can install an agent on your PC on the server, and it backs it up to the actual NAS, but it does it all using the Datto's own software. I think it's actually using Shadow Protect, which is a backup software, which I know Mike Smith's gone out before, and that software means that you can bring, if you have a server failure, you can actually bring the VM up on the actual device, on the actual NAS device itself. So you can actually do, as part of the backup procedure, once it's done the backup, you can actually boot from it inside the Datto box and it actually takes a screenshot of it as part of the backup, and it will test that the actual image is okay. So, and it also backs up the image to the cloud so you've got a copy in the cloud. So we basically used that. We restored it by basically when you click on restore on the data box, it basically presents it to the VHD file, and you can copy that VHD file to the terminal, to the Hyper-V host, and then you basically just create a new VM and put it in as a Hyper-V host. Sorry, a virtual machine. And then ping that virtual machine back up, and it was working fine for a bit. I was like, oh yeah, solved it. Next day we come in, it was pegging at 100% again. It was like 5 years on it. So it can't be anything wrong with that PC. What's wrong with that VM? So I restored it, renamed it, sysprepped it, put it back into the farm. So it's a brand new machine. We know it's a copy of TS1. We know it works. And it's TS2. Why is TS2 working? So cut a long story short, one of the colleagues at work said, why don't you check the hardware? Have you checked the hardware on the Hyper-V host? Because I've seen a problem with this before when you have dodgy memory. So I looked on the memory on the ILO. So you had a problem talking about this before. So HP servers have a thing called Intelligent Lights Act, which is basically a board which is on the motherboard, which is actually completely separate to the server. It's part of the motherboard. It used to be a separate card, but it's now part of the motherboard. And you can basically, you get given an IP address for that box. You can log on to that box. And you can kind of like look at if you're connected by the, actually look at the console screen. So it's like a virtual KVM.
There's a similar thing for Dell servers called iDRAC.
Yeah,
I think it's based on IPMI technology, which is, I think that's a lower level thing, which these go over.
Yeah, so this is basically, it's the HP version of it. And it's really good because you can force off the server and you can turn on the server as well if you need to. And normally, most new Generation 9 or 8 servers come with this feature. But if you want to look at the console after it's gone past the bar screen, you have to buy a license. And so, also, it's got direct access to the hardware. So if there's any fault on the hardware, you haven't got to have agents on the machine anymore to see what's wrong with the hardware, and it will show you what's wrong with the hardware and the issues. And there was a memory slot gone bad in it. A memory had gone bad. So I spent 2 hours on the phone to HP trying to get them to convince them that the memory slot was bad and can we get it replaced. And because it was in a data center, we had to get them booked, the HP engineer booked into the site, get the bits booked into it. It took about a long time to get it, but we got it fixed in the end, but it actually fixed the problem. So it was a hardware issue in the end, but a memory issue, but not, we were seeing a CPU issue. So, and no one has set the alerting up. If you buy the ILO Advanced license, you can enable the email alerting on it. So all the servers I put in personally, I always set that up so that if there's any hardware issues, like when this memory slot went bad, it actually went down, Barry memory slot went bad on the day the problem started occurring. So if that email alert had come through, we'd have known, we got an issue with the memory, and then we would have known that it would have been a thing. We wouldn't have spent 3 days trying to troubleshoot a problem which I didn't know was a hardware issue.
So. Yeah. I mean, I had a client where I was working on the Linux box, which was a VM on their VMware machine. And it was having real problems with, disk. It seemed like I/O was bad. So I was looking at it, just the Linux box. But they worked out that it was the actual hardware of the host that it was sitting on. So they migrated it over to another bit of hardware, and it worked fine. So, yeah, it's kind of, I didn't think about that. Didn't think that the underlying hardware for the...
Well, as the other VMs are working fine, so it can't be a problem with the host, if you know what I mean. But I'm going to be checking the hardware state. It's the first thing I'm going to be doing now when there's an issue.
Is there any kind of reporting you can get from the ILO stuff for HP? Because I know you could with Dell OpenManage.
So basically there's a thing called the IML log. I can't remember what it's called, but anything happens, it gets recorded in there. And basically, it's quite good because HP jumped on and took a load of bundles of the logs, and they actually found two memory sticks were faulty. One in the little GUI was like showing you that one memory stick was like slot three was memory in slot three is faulty, but also the memory in slot 11 was faulty as well, but that wasn't reporting in the GUI, so it's good to get HP on the case to.
Yes, well, I think you can get like Nagios plugins for ESX server, so because it's Linux underneath, you can, I don't know, you can get it to report on the hardware through ESX.
Yeah, this is a Hyper-V host, a VMware box. Microsoft box. But the good thing is you haven't got to put any agents on the actual box. It's all done by this ILO, which is a problem you had before with ESXi, because they're so lightweight now, it's really hard to get the agent on that. So
you can use WMI with Nagios and you know various other things. You can query WMI, I think, which is the for the benefit of the listeners, Windows Management Instrumentation. So you can get Linux to talk to that basically, and use the monitoring software of choice to you know report and alert on it.
Cool. So that's my story of the night.
Okay. Yeah. So I got a bit of an update. My promise to follow up on things that I mentioned in previous podcasts. I managed to get my daughter's laptop working. But it wasn't easy. So the original task was to take the spinning drive in there that was out, because it's one of those ones that you can fold the screen right back and it kind of becomes a tablet. So I thought a spinning drive really wasn't appropriate for that, and plus it's slow and so on. So I got a 120 gig SSD, and my plan was to just basically copy the data over that was on that spinning drive to the SSD, replace it within the laptop, that's it. Everything would be, you know, quiet, lower power usage, and everything would be faster, and everything would be great. I think that's true now, but getting there was quite a hard thing to do, really. The sort of steps that I went through, I had to, obviously the SSD was smaller than the spinning drive, so I had to shrink the partitions down on there. I ended up using, I think in the end, I did use Clonezilla, which you guys recommended in the last podcast. So I used that, but I created, because there's about four partitions. There's like a boot partition, because it uses EFI rather than sort of old-fashioned BIOS. There's like a rescue partition. There's some other partition, and then there's like the C drive, if you like, the main data partition. So I had to create those partitions individually, and then copy, you know, each partition from the old drive to the new drive. Once I'd done that, it wouldn't boot, and Andy pointed me in the right direction for that. I needed a Windows 8 CD, original CD, which luckily you can download from Microsoft these days free of charge and, you know, completely legally, whereas in the old days you'd probably have to get those through some other avenue. Luckily managed to, so Microsoft provide it these days, so that was good. The laptop itself hasn't got a CD drive though, so you've got an ISO file, but then you have to get that onto a USB stick and bootable by Windows. And I actually ended up using, I tried UNet booting, which is like the Linux solution, but unfortunately the Linux box I have didn't seem to recognise the USB key. My Mac recognised the USB key, but UNet booting wouldn't work. So in the end, I ended up booting up a virtual machine on my Mac, a Linux virtual machine, in order to make this USB key bootable. So once I've done, and I actually used the Linux bootloader grub to do that, to make the Windows USB key bootable. So yeah, so once I've done that, booted the Windows USB key, and there's a little utility on there called BootRec, which obviously fixes the boot the MBR and so on for the hard drive that's in the machine. Once I've done that, the machine booted, and then one of the last tasks was then to, because I'd shrunk all the partitions down to less than the size of the SSD, so I didn't have any problems moving everything over. I had to expand that to fill the size of the drive again. To do that, I needed to use Linux. I tried doing it using the Windows Logical Volume Manager, I think it's called, or Disk Management Tool, and it wasn't having it. So back into Linux, another bootable USB key. Uses the gparted program to expand the partition to fill the whole disk. And then that was it. That was the disk done. And then it was just the task of screwing everything back together. And, you know, these machines aren't really made to be taken apart and put back together, but managed it in the end. I actually used some jeweler's screwdrivers, which you mentioned in the last episode.
Oh, yeah. What was that original error? Is it had an error on boot, didn't it? I can't remember.
It was winload. It was looking for something called winload.efi.
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And I tried taking the new disk out, put the old disk in, and it was giving the same error for whatever reason. So, but I think that was EFI related because it's all new to me, this EFI stuff. So.
Yeah, that's why I said, you know, I thought you basically needed to get to some kind of command prompt.
Windows without command that, you couldn't. As well. Linux was no good. You could easily get to a Linux one, but getting to the Windows one was a bit more difficult.
Yeah, so you basically had to boot off the ISO off the bootable USB drive,
yeah.
Go into repair mode. I think it's repair advanced, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Troubleshooting advanced command prompt. Yeah.
That's it, yeah.
And then when you get to your black command prompt screen, then I'll give you a couple, didn't I? Which is SFC. What were the commands? Scan now, FSC.
I think, yeah.
Fix MBR. I was curious to know which one actually did it because sometimes my methods are just do them all.
Yeah.
And then if it works, then that's great. But the problem with doing that is you don't know what actually fixed it, but you figured out it was the bootrec one.
I only used bootrec. I think I did try another one that was in a how-to, but I can't remember it at the moment. But yeah, bootrec had four switches, bootrec / whatever. And I did each one of those. I don't know if one of those fixed them. But then I wasn't about to do one and then reboot it and then do another one and then reboot it and like that. So I just did all four and they seemed to work. So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that was good that worked out.
Yeah, I got there in the end. It took me a good couple of weeks to get that sorted out, much to my daughter's annoyance.
Is she happy though with it now though?
Oh yeah, she said it was slower though. I can't believe that. I think that's just perception. Subjective.
I had a very I wouldn't say awkward. It was playing about with me a bit. EUFI problem a couple of days ago. Because I picked up this laptop from somebody and basically I've known these people for a while and basically it was these people's it was their mother's. She was quite old and she just passed away and. They got all the stuff from the house and they had their computer, you see, it was a laptop. It's an Asus laptop. Everything's great. They went to boot it up and it has a password. And of course they can't exactly ask her what the password is, and they had no idea what the password is. So their kids sort of said, I can get rid of that password. So she said, how do you do that? So they said, we just wipe it and reload everything again. And then she was like, no, there might be pictures on here. There might be all sorts of stuff on here. We can't wipe it. Then she asked the kids, can you get into it without wiping it? And they didn't have a clue. So she phoned me up and said, can you get into this laptop and reset the password? Of course, initially I said, yes. And I said, I'll take it back with me, but it's relatively simple to reset a Windows password. So took it back, switched it on. I put my Trinity Rescue disc in, and switched the machine on. Went for the boot menu. No boot menu. It just went straight into Windows. And then I realized, this has got EUFI. So then it was, I mean, I've done this before, but this just seemed a lot more awkward. It was an AC.
Oh, yeah, you have to tell Windows initially to go into it, don't you, or something?
You do. And then I thought, well, you can go into, once you boot it up, you can tell it to reboot once you boot it up. But of course, I couldn't get in because of the password.
Yeah.
So I couldn't get in. So you go into settings and Windows key settings, blah, blah, blah. But because I couldn't get that past the password, I couldn't get to that bit. And then at one point, I was thinking, how the hell am I going to boot this damn thing up when I haven't got any access to the boot menu? And then I started just Googling around a bit. And then I suddenly remembered on Windows 8 or 8.1, I think this is just 8, even though you get to the password screen prompt, and then you've still got a power button on the bottom right-hand side of the screen that you can go to. You hit that, and you've got shut down, restart. Then I remembered, if you hit shift, I think it's the left shift particularly, but definitely shift, and restart, then it restarts in repair mode, right? So hit shift, restart, and then it restarted into repair mode. Now, that's the same mode that you were getting to where you got to the command prompt, went to troubleshoot, command prompt. Okay. I went to troubleshoot, and then one of the other options was disable EUFI.
Right.
So you select that, and then the machine reboots again, but then it doesn't boot to the Windows Secure Boot. It went straight to the BIOS.
Right.
Once you get into the BIOS, then, of course, you have to then scroll around in the BIOS and have a look for, firstly, well, that option isn't there initially. You have to go to, I'm trying to remember now. Find Secure Boot. Right. In the BIOS, there's an option for Secure Boot, and then you have to disable it.
Yeah.
Then you have to save the BIOS and exit. And then it reboots again. And when it reboots again, it goes straight back to the boot back into Windows again. And then you have to do another shift restart, and then it boots back to the BIOS. Because only the second time round can you then go into a boot menu and then have an option to move the CD-ROM above the Windows Secure Boot one.
All right.
So you can't do all this in one fell swoop in the BIOS. You have to disable Secure Boot, then reboot the computer, then restart, then go back into the BIOS, then you can change the boot order. Once so you change the...
You can't boot from like a Windows CD or USB key and get into the BIOS that way.
Not the BIOS, no, because it was only boot from to the hard drive, so the secure boot.
Yeah.
Unless you got into it, because I didn't have all these options because I couldn't get into the computer because I didn't know the password. So this is where I was a little bit stumped for a bit. Eventually, I had the Trinity Rescue Kit disk in, which I think is a Linux-based program, I'm sure. I don't know if you've ever used it before, but it's really good.
There's a utility on Linux called chntbw, which changed NT password, which is basically... finds the administrator password bit, and you can either reset it or change it to something that... a known value.
Yeah.
Trinity Kit free, or is it like...
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. Okay. If you just search Trinity Rescue Disk, it's an ISO. So you can put it on a CD or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it just, and if you get it to boot, it's all text based as well. There's not a bit of graphics in it, which is actually quite daunting for some people. But you just have to sit and read what it says, and then it actually makes a bit of sense. I'm quite used to it. I've used it on XP machines, 7 machines, you know.
Yeah, I've used a similar tool. It's got me out of a number of problems. So it was a Windows password which you couldn't get, which I didn't know. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
But the PC booted so fast using UEFI, you couldn't get into the BIOS to change it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because the F2 to get into the BIOS is just, it's either A, so fast, or B, it's disabled.
Okay.
You can't get into it, you know, pressing F2.
I wonder what happened if you had a problem with the hard drive and the hard drive fails and you have to reinstall Windows. I wonder what you'd have to do then.
Well, if you've got no hard... I was actually thinking about this. What if I took the hard drive out? It would actually boot to the BIOS because it's got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So then you could boot to the BIOS. So say the hard drive went, then you could take the hard drive out.
Yeah.
Or put a new one in. It would have nowhere to go. Then it would boot to the BIOS. Then you could disable secure boot. Yeah. And then you could put it to normal, as I call it. And then boot from the CD or whatever, and then reinstall it again. So that's a way around it, yeah.
I've got an interesting one as well. I've got an HP laptop I was given, which I wouldn't want anymore. And I don't know, they set a password on the BIOS, and you can't get into the BIOS to change it.
Oh, right.
And it's one, and I tried, like, you know, taking the battery out and stuff and shorting out the thing, but no, that doesn't work. Because, like, so I don't know how, I was wondering how I could get, I basically want to put Linux on it. So I was thinking about maybe taking the hard drive out, putting it onto another machine, installing it on that machine, and then taking the hard drive out and then putting it back in that machine. Because I've done that in the past, because it's basically configured to boot to the hard drive, but you can't change or anything to boot from a CD or USB stick. So
I see, yeah.
So it's a BIOS password rather than the boot password.
Yeah, the BIOS password in the BIOS.
I wonder if you can flash the BIOS. Don't know how you do it, but
I've never had success with this, but there are supposedly master passwords for technicians at HP, Dell, or whatever.
Yeah,
which are on the internet somewhere that you can, you know, use to get in. I don't know if you're able to find anything like that.
I think that's an urban myth. I don't think they exist.
No, I've looked for lists before. I've actually found lists, but they never work. Never work. if you can't flash the... Well, if you can't flash it, it depends how you'd have to flash it, because if you can't, you know, take the battery out and lose the memory that time, that means it must be hard-programmed on a ROM, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So...
I mean, with desktop motherboards, you used to get jumpers to... You could change the jumper to reset the BIOS, but I doubt there's jumpers on a laptop motherboard.
No.
But some of them they do, but there's no jumper exactly. But if you find out where the pins are, and then you just put a tip of a screwdriver on the two pins, it's the same thing.
Okay.
But would that work on a Linux machine? Because a Windows machine might go berserk. If you installed it on one piece of hardware... and then moved it to another piece of hardware. How would a Linux operating system like that? Would it maybe take longer the first time? Or
It would probably have issues with drivers, but the core system would come up.
As
long as you got the CPU and RAM and basic graphics card, then it would come up absolutely fine, and then you just fix it from there.
Yeah, because the machine I'm on now was hard drive in another machine first, on a different processor, and I put it in another board, and I'd take it off that machine, put it into this machine, and it just ran a couple of bits, did an update, and it kind of rebooted fine. So I might try that just to see.
The only problem you might have is if it's going from a 32-bit to a 64-bit. The other way around. If it came from a 64-bit and it's going to a 32-bit, then it might not work.
Well, I'll update people on that next week. I'll try that next weekend. So I've had a load of issues a couple of weeks ago, months ago. I was thinking about how I had a RAID 5 failure. So it wasn't one of our customers. It was someone who phoned up randomly. He said, we've lost, our servers lost its D drive. And it was that they had two disks fail in this RAID 5 set. So there's nothing we could do with it. So luckily had backups. So we basically had to rebuild the array and or basically get two brand new disks in and then recreate the array and then restore the data from backup. So I thought it'd be quite interesting to just talk about what RAID is and a bit of overview. We've done it, we talked about it a little bit in the past, but I thought we'd make a bit of a share out of it. So RAID stands for Redundant Array of Inexpensive Disks, now commonly known as Redundant Array of Independent Disks.
Are they not this inexpensive means, anymore?
No. Well, inexpensive, I think you like when if you're in a server, you normally use a kind of, if it's mission critical, using like an enterprise disk, which is designed to be running 24/7, aren't they? So basically, RAID means using a bunch of physical disks to make one virtual disk or one logical disk, depending on vendor. Normally, HP, this is called a logical volume, and Dell, this is normally called a virtual disk. This is a disk you would normally see in Windows, in Windows Disk Manager. So if you put those disks directly on the hard drive, without a RAID controller or anything, you would see those disks, those five disks, as separate disks. But with the RAID controller, you'd put it in and it would present, you'd configure those RAID, what RAID you wanted in the configuration tool. And then in Windows or Linux, it would show you that as one volume. So it wouldn't know that it was four or five disks.
So the configuration tool tends to be very low level, something you configure at boot time usually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there are a number of ways RAID can be deployed. Software which is controlled RAID by like the actual OS, like in Windows and Linux. So what that means is, like I was saying, you'd put the disks into, say like you're putting two disks in and you boot and you install Windows, you then go into Windows, you'd see those two disks in Windows. You would then create a mirror inside Windows and you would then merge those two disks together and it would then present it as one disk. I think you can do the same thing in Linux, can't you, Andy? I mean, Jerry?
It's called MD in Linux. I think it stands for multiple devices. Wanted to mention as well that you can combine the two. My old employer used massive amounts of disk and they would use the hardware RAID 5 so you get a lot of redundancy out of that. You can lose two disks out of any array and then they would stripe those RAID 5s into RAID 1s for speed. So you get the advantage of hardware redundancy, a hardware RAID controller, and then the speed of striping. But we might go into this, you know, RAID zero. RAID zero, not RAID one. So you stripe the RAID five or six arrays together into RAID zero, which is But I'll let you go on.
So that's a bit slow because obviously the OS is in charge of the is in charge of the RAID, so it's got to make decisions about where the data is, where it's been recorded, and it can be. So it's a bit of a nightmare. I've had it fail on me twice. One when I was shutting a server down, and it wouldn't shut. I spent ages. It took about 4 hours to shut down. It never finished shutting down, and I had to reboot the server in the end, and the server would never reboot again, so I had to completely rebuild the server. Second one is that I had a problem where I think one of the disks failed, but there's no way of telling which of the disks failed, and I unplugged the wrong one, and then I put a new disk in and it never rebuilt properly, kind of thing. So I've never really enjoyed software RAID. I like leaving it to the actual having a physical hardware. There's like a middle ground before we go to the hardware range where you actually have a physical controller card. Whereas, if you buy a motherboard or whatever for a PC or a workstation, you get like a RAID on the motherboard card, and it's like you can, when you first boot it up, you can kind of configure the RAID in the BIOS, and you can configure normally a mirror disk.
Hmm.
And then the problem you've got is that you can then you then have to, in Windows, when you're setting up Windows, you have to press F6 to install a driver, and that driver is like a virtual RAID card, and yeah. it then it does all the magic for you.
So you need a driver to basically interpret what the RAID card is telling.
Yes.
Is telling you.
Yes.
I think that was similar with the hardware RAID on the Dell servers that I used to work with. You needed this kernel module to get to basically understand the hardware RAID. So the OS understood the hardware RAID.
Yeah, because you get the hardware RAID where it actually still only presents a disk, but this software RAID actually, the two disks are presented to the OS, but this virtual driver kind of combines them in two, so it only sees it as one disk. And because a lot of these drivers are only supported in Windows and not on Linux and ESXi, so like I had a server where I had the server failure the other month or so, and I was like, oh, I know what, they hadn't got a license for VM for Microsoft. I thought, I know what, I'll put VMware on it because that's free, and then I can import the VM. But no, because it had this software RAID on the motherboard, but it wasn't supported in ESXi or Linux. Because what had actually happened is, to actually get the data off the server what had failed, I basically booted it off the Linux CD to actually pull the data off. And when it was in Linux, it saw two separate drives. It didn't see it as one drive, if you know what I mean. And again, when you boot it up into Windows, there's no nice GUI normally to tell you if the hard drive's going to fail or anything. Normally you don't get a very good bit of software to, because you want to know if a disk fails, don't you? Yeah. So that you can replace it, or if you're getting issues with it.
You said that one of the disks failed. You booted up in Linux. Could you see the data on just one disk?
No, both disks came along. So that's why I'm saying like it doesn't present it correctly. The motherboard's not presenting the two disks as one disk as if you're running a RAID card. So normally, with the HP and the Dell, you get like a physical RAID card which you plug the hard drives into. So you're not plugging it in directly into the motherboard, you're plugging it into the RAID card. And again, when you boot the server up, you normally get like a little BIOS again you can go into, like you press F10 or whatever. And in there, you then go and you create your RAID sets, and then you create your logical disk, and then that logical disk is then presented to the server. And then obviously, when you install Windows, you have to press F6 and install the drivers, and obviously then it knows how to talk to that RAID controller, and the RAID controller goes, "Yep, here's your disk. You don't need to worry about the disk underneath of it." And obviously, you haven't got the worries of the software on the operating system trying to work out, are we writing stuff to which disks or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's all related to a hard, it's like a physical controller. But I'm guessing those physical controllers actually are running Linux, aren't they? Probably a little Linux system on there, and it's pretending doing the RAID, a low level kind of thing.
I'm not sure if it's Linux, but it's some embedded system, you know, that it's basically doing what the software RAID software is doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the same technology, but it's because it's in hardware.
And
it's
again,
faster.
And again, these boards will have things like memory on them and backup flash batteries. But I'll go into that in a bit longer. Okay. So, and also as well, the RAID controllers normally store the config on the card and on the disk. So if you ever have a RAID card failure, which I've had in the past, if you just replace the RAID card and it makes sure it's the same firmware as it before, it will, first time it will boot, it will download the config off the disk and flash it to the motherboard. Sorry, to the RAID card. So it's really kind of that, is that, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah. If you had it's something I've been going to mess about with for ages, but I haven't yet. Because, now I've mentioned before, I've got this Buffalo server that's which was now considered as failed. Right. But the disks are still there, you see. Now, I'm pretty sure that was kind of, is that Linux run that Buffalo server? I presume it was. It had one hard drive in the server. It's only just about just bigger than one hard drive in size. So it had one hard drive in the server, and I had one USB hard drive, which you plugged into the back. Now, when you used to connect to that, it, as you said before, it's just seen it as one drive. So if you went to network places or whatever, you see the Buffalo drive, you select it, it sees it as one drive. So that must have been set up on a RAID array, which would be what? If it's two hard drives all seen as one, is that RAID 0?
RAID 1. Well, yes. Either RAID 0 or RAID 1. But RAID 1 means that the disks are mirrored, so all the data on one is copied to the other. With RAID 0, the data is on both disks, so if you lose one disk, then you lose all the data.
I was pretty sure... Well, I can't be certain now thinking about it, but I was pretty sure that it went across two disks because the internal disk wasn't that big, so I put a bigger one in and it just expanded the size.
Yeah, so let's say you had like 2 400 gig drives with RAID one, you'd have
the terabyte, yeah.
No, you'd have 500 gig with RAID one.
Yeah.
With RAID one, yeah, but I had a terabyte.
All right, so it's RAID zero.
Yeah, it's a bit RAID zero.
Yeah,
I'll go on in a minute. I've got it in my notes to read next. They're gone.
Okay. So, so I've got those two hard drives, which must have been RAID as RAID 0. Yeah. Now, those two drives are still intact because they haven't been touched. It's only the Buffalo communication part that went, that's gone bad. So, if I was to take those two cards, I've got a little RAID PCI card here somewhere. If I was to get that, connect them up to a RAID PCI card and put it in a machine, and then boot up into the little BIOS of the RAID card, as you just said. Could that RAID then be recreated?
I think you might have more luck putting both hard drives in an old desktop, and booting Linux, because. Reason I say that is that if, on a sort of cheap NAS, like the one you're describing, I think it's probably going to be software RAID, a Linux software RAID, and if you boot up Linux, off a USB or whatever, you probably want to install it properly, and then give it two software RAID drives, it should be able to assemble that RAID array from those two drives
by itself.
Yeah, because it uses the two disks will have information on them that ties them to each other. If you connect it up to like a hardware PCI RAID card, it's more likely to be like a proprietary kind of RAID, which won't work. That's what I think anyway.
Okay.
That's what I would suggest you do, because I reckon Buffalo must use some sort of Linux RAID to do it. So I'd say get an old PC, put a disk in it, install Ubuntu on it or whatever, and then attach those two disks after you install it. Reboot the server, reboot PC, shut the PC down, stick the two disks in it, and then boot it up again and see what drives come about.
Yeah,
what they are.
I mean,
just plug them into the SATA ports on the motherboard, just like any other hard drive.
Yeah,
and then it will boot up, and then hopefully Ubuntu will see three disks.
Yes,
with it, the system disk, and then two extra.
Yes,
yeah,
and then we should be able to go on those. You know, to quote Windows terms, D drive and E drive, you know, and see them on the that sounds pretty good.
Look at the MDADM command for that. I can give you a hand maybe and we can report back on the next podcast perhaps.
I'll have a go just doing it that simple way and see if it's successful, and if it's not, I'll give you a shout and then need something else doing.
Yeah, I think you would have to create some sort of, there's like utilities out there that says it can do it, which you can pay for. It's basically risk rebuild the array for you if you take the two disks out. What was that command again, Jerry?
MDADM. That's the, like this for administering MD devices.
Yeah. What was it? MDADM.
Yeah, should be in any Linux distribution.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So going back, I was just uninterested to getting that data off. Then I was thinking there must be someone must have done it in the past. So
the reason I say it's probably Linux Software Raid is because my little cheap NAS box is using that, and I just put an alternative firmware on there a few months ago, and it's just the MDADM commands that it's using. So.
So what I was saying about you create these virtual disks or virtual logical disks, you need some sort of RAID underneath it. So what we said before, so the first type of RAID is called striping, which is no redundancy, called RAID 0. You require more than two disks. So the data is normally split into blocks of 46K. The first block is written to disk 1, and the second sector is written to do disk 2, and then if it's got only two disks, it would get ripped back to the first disk, and then the next thought sector would written to be the disk 2. So let's say you had two 400 gig drives and you put into a RAID 0, you'd have a 1 terabyte a logical disk. The problem you've got then is that if you lose a disk, then you lose all your data, because the data's not stored anywhere. So
that's why it's called striping. You literally write one bit on one disk, one bit on the next disk, and one bit on the next disk. And that's just how it works. So if you lose a disk, you lose, you know, however much data, and none of your data makes sense anymore. So
you'd lose everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
But so what's the benefit of running that then?
Right. It's because faster. It's faster.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're writing 100 megabytes data, each drive is writing 50 meg at once, compared to one drive writing 100 meg, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
So it's twice as fast and reads data twice as fast as both disks can find the data without when it's being requested. And also there's no storage space lost in RAID 0.
Is this the one as well where you can go stupid and keep adding hard disks and it gets faster and faster and faster?
Yeah, I think we mentioned with the raiding the SSDs together before, didn't we? Yeah.
Okay. Next is mirroring, which is RAID 1, which requires two disks the same size. Each block of data is written to both drives. You lose half the storage. So if you've got two 1 terabyte disks, you will have 1 terabyte virtual disks. There's a hit on writing speed, as both disks need to confirm that data has been written to both disks before the next bit of data is allowed to be written. You might get a bit of fast reader speed on RAID 1 as you have two heads seeking for data. RAID 1 has got a tolerance of one disk failure. Does that make sense, Andy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So we can fail one disk and still operate.
Yes.
See, I'd have thought RAID 1 would be faster as well, because Say you've got a, this is my way of thinking, you know, it's probably not RAID's way of thinking, but say you've got a file you want to pull off that's 100 megabytes, right? Mm-hmm. Then why doesn't it just take 50 off one drive and the other 50 simultaneously off the other drive?
Well, that's what he's saying. Read can be faster, but writing is definitely slower.
Right.
You've got to write it both times. Yeah. You've got to check something or something to make sure that they're the same bit of data.
Yeah.
Okay, got you.
Okay, so RAID 5 is the next one, because there's a spec for RAID 2, 3 and 4, but no one uses them. So RAID 5 means you can get greater storage, but you always lose one disk for parity. So let's say you have four disks in an array, that's four times 1 terabyte disks. your storage space you would get will be 3 terabytes, okay? Parity is an equation using exclusive OR. Let's think there's an easier way of doing this. So data written on disk, so let's say, okay, in this is a simple term. On disk one, you write 2. On data on disk 2, you write 4. And on data on disk 3, you write 5. Parity would add all those numbers together, and that together would be 11. That is then written on the 4th disk. Okay, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that, how that works? So you've got 4 disks in my array. And you've got disk 1, 2, and 3. On the first disk, you write 2. On the second disk, you write 4. And on the 5th disk, you write 5. And obviously, what the parity does in simple terms...
On the third disk, you write 5, sorry.
Yeah, on the third disk, you write 5. The parity of that data is all then plus together. And that's then written on disk 4, okay? So if you ever lost... the drives 1 to 3, the RAID we could work out what the value of disk lost because of the equation. So you've got 11, with a parity of 11. What do we say?
You got 2 and a 5.
Yeah. So we could work out if we lost disk, the parity. We could subtract the other value of disk 2 and 3. So 11 would be 11, 4 minus 5 would equal. So if we lost disk 1, okay. We could subtract the values of disk 2 and 3 off 11.
Which is 9.
Yep, we would be left with 2. So that's the data.
Yeah.
So that's the data was stored on 1.
That actually makes it really clear. I've never heard it explained that clearly before. So you know what the number adds up to. And that's why you can tolerate the loss of one disk, because if you lose any more, then you can't work out what those numbers are.
So that's like in real layman's term. So you've had a disk failure and request that data. The RAID controller has to recalculate that data. And that's if you have a disk failure in a RAID 5, you will get a slow performance because the RAID controller's got to work out what the data is missing. Okay. So it would be slower until the RAID's been reconfigured. Okay. So the parity is not... the parity is not always stored on one disk. You don't want a disk stored on one disk because that would just be bad. So what happens is, on the first go, data is stored on disk 1 and data B is on disk 2 and data C is on disk 3 and then parity on 4. Next time... probably what happened was that disk 2 would have data A, disk 3 would have data B, and disk 3 would have data C. But the first disk would have the parity, if you see what I mean. So
it's distributed parity. So
yes.
You don't always get the parity on one disk.
Yeah. So that's an easy thing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a link in the show notes about what exclusive OR is. It's a nice computer file thing about how it works and how you can get any number from it. I'm not going to explain it here because it's just easy to do this thing. And also a link to how RAID 5 works with the actual binary levels. Because I'll just make it simple with numbers, but obviously it works in binary, okay?
I want to add something to this. It's about something called bit rot, which is... something that can happen with the huge disks we have these days. Basically, bits get flipped. So if you see, and it can have effects. So you see like a video file and something isn't quite right on it. That's basically the compression of the video compensating for bits getting lost on hard drives. So the data in your hard drive isn't as safe as you might think, basically. And one of the things about ButterFS, which is this file system that I mentioned last time, is if you have a RAID 1 array, it can actually detect, it actually does this whatever on the disk, and it detects when that's actually happening to the data, which is something that RAID doesn't do. Because like if you get, say, in a RAID 1 array, you get some data just through random causes just being changed. it will faithfully copy it to the second hard drive. And that is probably something that, that might come into sort of RAID controllers in the future. But at this point, I think the RAID specification doesn't allow for that. So
no, and that's why that Alan Jude guy goes off on about ZFS a lot, because that does data integrity checks as it's doing stuff.
And BusterFS does that as well,
So coming back to that in a minute about your disk size and stuff, I want to come across that. So the problem with RAID is that you get is a quick read speed, but write speed is quite slow because it has to work out the parity as it's writing it to the disk. Does that make sense? So when you're writing your data to disk, it's got to work out that parity. And obviously, again, it's got to confirm that it's written to the disk before you can write the next bit of data. Okay. So this is where you can get a thing in a disk in a physical RAID controller, a thing called a write bus cache. So what happens is actually a physical memory on the RAID controller where it actually writes the data to a cache module first, and then it says, yep, I've got that data, now continue, what do you want me to write next? In the background, it writes that to the disks. Does that make sense? So you normally want to have, also, you really want to have a backup battery on the cache chip, because let's say you have a power cut while you're writing to the cache. When the server comes back up, that memory's got to be gone from the cache because it's obviously non-volatile. Right. So not the backup with it on the UPS, but a backup battery for the cache, okay?
Like a little pencil battery type of thing, is it?
Yes. And people might have this in the past where you've had RAID where you had performance issue. And if you've got a RAID card, which no one sold, either A, hasn't sold a cache battery for it, or the cache battery dies as it does after the thing and you get slow performances, the RAID controller will basically disable the cache, if you see what I mean, because it doesn't want to lose that data. And then you get slow performance because you've got to work out the parity before it writes it to the disk. So if you lose a disk in a RAID 5 set, you're going to be vulnerable until that disk is replaced.
It'll still work.
Yes, because it's working out the parity on the card, because when you request a bit of data, it works that parity out. If you're diskless, the problem you've got is that if you use a second disk, then you're stuffed, because you have got that, you never, it's going to be, because you lost your data, because it can't reconstruct the data. So in modern day RAID cards, you could have a hot spare. So if it does detect a disk failure and it says, oh, this disk is going to go bad, it will automatically put that disk into the RAID and it will then start the rebuilding process. Well, I think it actually might be called, is it called resilvering, Andy? Have you heard that? Or Jerry, have you heard that called resilvering?
I haven't heard it,
but I like it.
I think it's called resilvering. It's like the official term. I always call it rebuilding, which is going to be slow again until the RAID configures. Right. The problem is, when you replace a disk, every single bit of data on the RAID has got to be rewritten. So it's got to be reread, which can cause a further disk failure to work out the parity, if you see what I mean. So if you have a disk failure, because normally you buy your disk at once, and normally if one disk is going to fail, the other disk is going to fail as well. Okay. And the problem with these days, if you have a load of big disks, like a 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, 4 terabyte disks, that may take days for it to reconstruct the data. Because if you think about it, it's got to read every single bit of data in a disk to regenerate the parity. But at the same time, the OS is asking for data, if you see what I mean. So that's got like a SQL database. It's reading that data. That's going to have a higher priority than rebuilding it, if you see what I mean. So that's where RAID 6 comes in, okay, where you can have double parity. So you have a second disk. So you put the second, you have two parities. So when it works out the parity, it stores that parity to two separate disks. So if you have a disk fail, you won't need to rebuild it because that parity is on another disk. So if you put a replacement disk in, it will be easier to rebuild an array.
So does that have one? What's the minimum amount for Raid 5 and what's the minimum amount for Raid 6? Is it one more?
I think so, isn't it?
It'd be 3 for Raid 5 and 4 for Raid 6, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because you need one spare disc for Raid 5 and you need two spare discs for Raid 6.
Yeah, so Raid 6 you will lose the two discs and Raid 5 you lose one disc.
Okay.
So the next thing is that you can do nested raid, but I'm going to leave that for another night, where you can like have raid 50 and raid 10, where you like you combine mirroring and striping into one.
I was going to ask what I thought 10 was actually raid. You call it raid 10, but it's actually raid 1 and 0, isn't it? Combined.
Yeah, I want to go away and research that a bit more before I want to commit to it, because I spent quite a
lot
bit
more
of time.
Complicated.
You can get 0+1 as well, just to make it harder.
Well, now with that parity thing, I was just thinking before, you know that a lot of barcodes, especially on your grocery shopping and that. So if you look on the back of your box of Frosties, then it's got a barcode, right? And that barcode has a parity number at the end. It's usually the first number or the last number outside the set of the normal numbers. They call it a check number or something like that. But effectively, it's like a bar. It's like a parity number. And it's in case, when you scan in your self-checkouts or whatever, or maybe the barcode's got damaged, or if the packaging is kind of like flexible, it's got half missing part of the or it's stuck under a flap or something. It uses that check number
to check if the barcode's
to check it out. Yeah, so they add them all up and what it's supposed to do on a barcode. I think I don't know if that's the video you're going to put on, but there's a number file video about barcodes and how it uses the check number at the end. Basically, they make the barcode number up, they put the check number at the end, so when you do the calculation or add them all together, say, it always comes to the same number. It's expected to come to a particular number. And if it doesn't, one number's missing. And say it's coming to number 50, and it got, and the number it's added up is 48, it knows there's two missing. So the missing barcode number is number 2, you see. So that's, to me, that sounds very similar to that parity checking in the hard drive. But there isn't, I don't know if you've seen that, Al.
But this one was about, we'll put a link in the show notes to your one, but the one I was talking about is Exclusive Rule, where it tells you how it works out, how it works out, if you know what I mean.
How XOR works.
Yeah.
Exclusive Rule. Yeah. But I mean, there's all these concepts of computer science, isn't it? It's all different aspects of computer science. And, a barcode is one aspect and RAID is another, because they're basically concerned with data integrity, aren't they? So
there's a lot of parity checking on CDs and DVDs and things like that as well.
Yeah.
Uses the same thing on that, because to a degree, because you can have a CD which is pretty scratched up or whatever. Mm. They used an example on a video you saw where they got a marker pen and, put a black mark on the CD. Mm. And it still played, even though that bit of data was clearly missing. Because they could parity check it, it still knew what the values of it missing was.
Yeah. So.
We had an email in since our last show, which is quite good.
We did.
I think we had it yesterday as we record. So with any luck, this person's going to get their email read out. It's very close to when they sent it. So
I got this. I got it 15 hours ago from when we... So he knows when he sent it.
Yeah.
So we're doing this podcast 15 hours after he sent it.
I believe it's... is it Brad Torrey?
Brad Torrey, yeah. Hear him quite a bit on different Podnuts podcasts. So that's great. So I'll read it out if you want. I've got it up here. So he said... Al's toolkit was really extensive. This is talking about the toolkits we were talking about last week, wasn't it? I've been thinking about doing a toolkit episode on Podnuts, but this one is pretty close to mine. Nice kit out. Any things I might add are extra Cat 6 patch cables from 3 to 14 foot, batteries, video cables, HDMI, DVI, and display port to DVI cables, and some Cat 5 and Cat 6 keystones. I also have a toner for tracing cables with me most of the time. So he says, so that's it. Happy New Year, gents, as well.
That sounds like a really good idea, like a marker pin or something to trace the cable, yeah.
I think he's actually talking about a toner. I think it's like the BT engineers. You ever seen them using where they kind of put and it goes beep, 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 and I think you put it on. I don't know how it works, but maybe email us, let us know. But I think you put it one end, and then you can kind of it's like a clip. I think it's a battery, and then two end bits, and you clip it in, and then you can put this cable thing, and it will basically beep to show you where the if it's got. Kind of thing.
Right. Okay.
We used to work when I used to work at Unilever. We used to have I worked in the engineering departments, and we used to have. Cable tracers, if someone was going to have to dig up a road or something, or dig out a drain or whatever, they'd have to go along and see if there was any pipes or cables underneath the ground. So I think it put like a pulse out or something like that, or electromagnetic pulse, and if there was anything metal underground, similar to a metal detector, I suppose. But we used to call them toners for the same sort of reason.
Okay.
And also, he was talking about, on the email, about a keystone. I think they're like the jacks, what go into the wall, I think. I'm not too sure. I googled it earlier. I think that's what it means, maybe what they are. Also, if you remember, we had an email in a couple of weeks ago about, someone was asking about that if he could uninstall Exchange, he had DirSync set up. He had an Office 365, he had an Office 365 migration.
Oh, yeah.
And he wants to know if he could remove uninstall the Office 365, the on-site Exchange. And I said, I'd ask my Office 365 guru guy.
Oh, yes, I remember, yeah.
And the reason, right, so I've been doing a bit of Office 365 migration this week. And with Office 365, I now understand is that Office 365 is like Exchange in the cloud. So if you didn't have anything called DirSync, I'll go about in a minute, is that you would go in to a control panel on Office 365, and that's where you can add in the email accounts, username and password. Where if you wanted to add like an email address to someone's user account or email address box, you go onto the website and you would then go in there and edit it in the actual Office 365 portal. DirSync is a way of replicating what is on your on-site AD into Office 365. So let's say you have DirSync for passwords. It would DirSync your passwords from your on-site AD and sync up to the cloud into Office 365. If you do DirSync, everything is controlled. You can't modify much of the email settings. It has to be all done through the AD side. So if you wanted to add because in AD, in using a computer, you can go in there and you can add your email address in. That syncs that email address and puts it into Office 365. So you link your AD account to your account in Office 365, if that makes sense. And the reason you can't uninstall Exchange is because Exchange puts some attributes into the schema. And if you wanted to add, you can have a new email server, you can have your main email address, like Alistair at admin podcast, but you could also have Al at admin podcast.co.uk, and they both go to the same email account. That's normally called an alias. And if you've got Exchange already installed on site, you could add that by going into the Exchange tool and adding that in. And that adds it into the schema of your account and that alias. And that's why you can't modify anything in the cloud. Everything you want to do with a user account has to be done on your local AD. And that's why you can't really uninstall Exchange, because I reckon if you uninstall Exchange, it probably wipes all that information out of the schema, wipes the stuff out of your user account, and obviously it then won't get synced up to the cloud, if that makes sense. So that's probably why you can't remove Exchange from your local machine, from your local site, because it will take you out.
Attributes.
That's the word. Attribute. Yeah, of your account are all stored locally, and then they get synced up to the cloud into Office 365, and that's why everything's done locally on your machine, on your local domain. So hopefully that helps. So I think we've been going for about an hour, haven't we, guys? Yeah, about an hour.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
we'll go over that.
Cool. I think we'll leave it there. We'll come back next week and we'll talk about nested RAID. And I've got a couple of things I've been quite doing with SPF records. Is it stay? The simple, what's SPF for?
Sender policy framework.
Yeah, but we'll go about that next week. So, I think we're. Andy's also been playing on his guitar lately, hasn't he? So he's going to leave us on a little. We're going to go out on his latest rock version of Game of Thrones theme music. So I'll link in the show notes to the YouTube video so you can watch him play it if you want to. So we'll speak to you all soon, guys.
All right, see you soon.
Yeah, don't forget you can mail in, send any emails to mail@admin.co.uk. And also hit us up on social media channels as well. Just search for Admin Podcast. You'll probably find us.
Cool. Bye.
Bye now.